Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits, with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
ESPN 97.5 and 92.5 proudly present The Killer Bees.
Definitely a fan of The Killer Bees.
Don't sweat the technique.
Now from the Veritex Community Bank Studios, bringing you the fastest 3 hours in Houston sports radio, here's Joel Blank and Jeremy Branham.
Ooh, what up, H-Town? Hey, how we doing?
He's Blank, I am Branham. It's AJ behind the glass. How about that? Brian, yeah. Not working again. Shocker, huh? I'm Brian. He never works. See, I feel like he doesn't work more days than he works. How do you feel about that?
I feel it's pretty accurate. Yeah. He's right? He's definitely on the Charlie Pulillo School of Vacation.
Yeah, I think so. It's a good gig if you can get it. It's not a good gig if you're the head coach of the New Orleans Saints. That's not a good gig if you can get it, although the buyout I'm sure is pretty good. Dennis Allen fired. Look, we're going to talk a lot about the Texans. Tomorrow is the trade deadline in the NFL. Can the Houston Texans fix what is ailing them ahead of tomorrow's trade deadline? I believe, what do you believe from this college football weekend? Mailbag Monday. We like to ask you what you want to ask us, and then we'll let you ask those questions later on. Game balls to give out from around the NFL as well. So we get to plenty of that. But the news of the day, I think, in the sports world, the Saints sacking Dennis Allen. They got off to a pretty good start, Blankers. It's like, oh, are the Saints going to like somewhat contend in what is a bad division? Then injuries hit and things got sour and bad there quickly. And Dennis Allen's is goner. He's done. He's out in New Orleans.
Yeah, it's unbelievable, because we were talking after the Cowboys game when they absolutely just blew the doors off the Cowboys. We were asking if we overlooked how good the Saints actually were. Their defense played really well. Kamara was all over the field doing whatever he wanted. Shaheed was a deep threat and you know, a threat whenever he had his hands on the football. And you're like, man, maybe there's more talent than we thought. Maybe because that division is so wide open, they got a legit chance. And now here we are a few weeks later going, yeah, no, it's the same Derek Carr. It's really a stagnant offense. The defense didn't live up to billing, and they weren't very good. And the scapegoat of all of it becomes Dennis Allen real quick.
Yeah, I'm not a big fan of firing coaches in the middle of the year either. Like, I really don't know what it accomplishes. Like, if you're a team, like the Jets are a little bit of a different story, where it's, okay, we have one more move to see if we can make a run at this thing. It's like a team that has playoff aspirations. You know, maybe the coach is holding them back. Let's try one final, you know, Hail Mary to turn this thing around. But when you're a team like the Saints and you're 2-7 and you're not very good, I really don't understand the point of firing a coach 9 games into the year. Because what are you trying to accomplish other than to like let everybody know, hey, we're open for business, we're going to have a head coaching opening, which I think you can do it with back channels. Like, everybody talks to agents, hey, you know, this job is probably going to come open if you have a client that might be interested in this job. I really don't know what it accomplishes for these really, really bad teams. I don't get it, to be honest.
I think it used to be that you wanted to get a head start on the market in case there were guys out there or guys that were, you know, unemployed for over a year or going into the season, to where you can be the first to talk to them. I think a lot of times in college, that's one of the things that people say why they make the changes quickly. But from a pro perspective, you're right. I mean, the Jets went way too soon, sooner than most teams would ever even consider. But because that was an extremely, you know, volatile situation, because there's so much pressure to win with Aaron Rodgers seemingly making every call. There was just a lot of extra there. But other than that, you might as well just ride it out, because honestly, if you're the Saints, you want the highest pick you can get. And I don't know, sometimes when you make a coaching change in season, it gives you a little energy for a week or two. You might as well at this point ride out the storm, be as bad as you can be, literally embrace the suck yet again, and then just make the change and have a clean break at the end of the year, when you're going to make a clean break on a lot of things.
Yeah, like, I don't want to rally the troops, to your point. That's exactly it. Like, let's make this a Texans conversation. Whenever you had David Culley and you were in the mix, you know, for a top pick, or the year that you had Lovie Smith and you won the final game, they got you the second pick and you got Stroud, like, that was very lucky. But I wouldn't have wanted the Houston Texans to fire a coach and then in the interim give them that dead cat bounce where they win like 3 of 4 games in the middle of the year. They turn Harmel was a top two pick into like the seventh pick of the draft. That's why I don't really get it. It doesn't make a whole lot of sense. Like Darren Rizzi, good luck. He's the interim coach there in New Orleans. Good luck. Like they don't want you to win. They might fire sell ahead of tomorrow. And yes, you have some veterans. You have Derek Carr. Maybe they force your hand. Like, hey, let's see what we get with Spencer Rattler the rest of the way. Somehow they got the extension with Kamara, which is a really weird deal. But at what point are you like, okay, we know that an aging running back is delicate, right? So let's try to keep the tread on the tire a little bit low in the final 5-6 games of the year whenever they get there because he's under contract. Like if you have Alvin Kamara under contract for the next couple of seasons and you think that if you can bring in a coach next year that makes you competitive in that division, you really don't want to use a whole lot of Alvin Kamara this year because what's the point of having him take 30 touches a game when you're competing for the number one spot in the NFL draft. So that's a weird situation. Their contracts, like their salary cap situation is abysmal. It is atrocious. I almost feel like that organization just needs to press the reset button and start completely over.
Yeah, I really agree with you. I think that when you look at it, and, you know, they still have some pieces, but, you know, Cam Jordan maybe has some value at the deadline. They've got a couple of guys in their secondary that might have some value across the league. But I think that's one where you just really have to look at how much do I have to reset? How many young guys do I want to keep? Yes, we've got some young receivers that can play, so that's a good start. But you have Carr under contract. It's a monster contract. No one else wants him. He's not very good. Ex-receivers are dragging him all through Twitter at the end and during games, and Michael Thomas, and then reporters are getting Derek Carr to respond to it, which was ridiculous.
Yeah.
But it is a complete crap show all over the place, and you just got to figure out with 24 hours before the deadline, or give or take, what can we possibly do to enhance our chances of kind of really expediting the rebuild in the offseason and get some picks?
That wasn't the only team making a coaching change today. Raiders, and it's kind of the same deal. This one maybe makes a little bit more sense. They fired their offensive coordinator, and it's like, okay, maybe this is Antonio Pierce trying one final chance, maybe to save his own job, right? Because if you're – look, it's first-year head coach. We don't think that Pierce could be going anywhere. Maybe he can be. I don't know. Like, I don't know what they're going to decide to do there with Mark Davis and, you know, making these coaching changes. And we've heard that they are cash poor in the past, although we haven't really heard that lately. This is one where I feel like a first-year head coach that fires their OC, they're trying to save their own job. Like, they're trying to preserve their own job. And usually you see it at the end of the year, and then you make that offensive coordinator the scapegoat. The reason that we're seeing it in the middle of the year, I think, is because I think Antonio Pierce thinks his job is not safe. Well, I think he's on the hot seat.
I think he is, too. And I think that when you look at it and you think about it, Mark Davis likes splashy moves. He likes big-time, look-at-me, attention-grabbing moves, and that's the Raiders that his dad used to run, and that's the same way he likes to do business. And now you add Tom Brady as a minority owner, and one thing that you know for sure is that Tom Brady, if he's got his hand in the cookie jar, they're going to be looking at how do we improve the team. And if Antonio Pierce isn't that kind of guy, then they can move on from him. And in Vegas, I'm never going to have the woe is me's about the Raiders financially because I know that they are selling tickets like mad. They're making money hand over fist. And in a new market, you normally do. And if you think about it and you want to connect the dots, is there a possibility that a guy like Belichick would be a guy that Davis would be enamored with and with Tom Brady, depending on the relationship, going, you want a guy that's going to come in here and not take any crap in the locker room and try and straighten some things out? That's the dude.
Two things. Fair enough on the riches of Las Vegas. It's a good point. NFL teams really aren't hurting for a whole lot of money. There's nothing minority about Tom Brady. I'll go ahead and say that. But it'd be hilarious if Tom Brady hires Bill Belichick and Tom Brady's Bill Belichick's boss. Like that would be hilarious. That'd be a little bit ironic.
But from a splash standpoint, you know that's the kind of move Davis wants to make.
I think there's a bigger splash.
Okay.
Deion.
Yeah, we kind of kicked that. Remember, because he was
courting
Shadur.
Yeah. What if you get Shadur? You get Shadur, you get Deion. It's a package. The Raiders are going to have a high draft pick. Like, that one makes some sense. Like, I wonder, though, if Deion would be okay with being the reason that Antonio Pierce only lasts 1 year in Vegas, though.
I think Deion's all about Deion. I don't think he cares. I just think that he's gotten to the point now in the way that he's doing things that he just wants total control, which is going to be a dicey proposition if you're going to tell somebody that Deion Sanders is going to be a first-time NFL head coach and you're going to give him a lot of control. That would be frightening because the general manager still has to be the guy that makes the personnel decisions.
Yeah.
And that's where I think that Deion already has too much control sometimes in Colorado when we hear like the way he's laying down rules on the media and taking away passes and doing things, you know, everything – playing his son's theme song music instead of the band and touchdowns.
He denies that. He denies that.
You can get by with a lot of that in college when you're bringing the attention to a Colorado program like he is. I don't think you can get away with that same kind of swagger in the NFL when you haven't been there and done that.
I want to see it, though. Like, you're probably ultimately right, but I want to be here and watch that reality show.
Sure.
Like, I think it'd be great entertainment. I really want to see it happen because of the entertainment aspect of it. Dak Prescott is going to be out a couple of weeks. It doesn't look like he's going to play against the Texans, which, to me, I know that Dak hasn't been great this year, and a lot of Cowboy fans are out on Dak. I think it makes that more winnable of a game for the Houston Texans. But the Cowboys are a weird team, man. Like, they're not good. Dak Prescott is mouthing bad word, suck. He's out for multiple weeks. CeeDee Lamb got hurt late in that game, although says that he's going to play. Like, they're a mess right now in Dallas.
Yeah, I think that they went from buyers, and Jerry Jones said going into the weekend he thought that they would be buyers going to the deadline, and there's a legit chance that they could be sellers. I think they actually looked better with Cooper Rush late in that game than what Dak was doing until Dak got hurt. I think that, you know, you've got CeeDee Lamb, you locked him up. But I saw a stat today where Dak and CeeDee Lamb's contracts for next season are like 45%+ of their cap for next year. So that's a ton. And so you have to start going from, instead of being buyers, do we start selling off pieces that other teams might want? Like, your biggest trade chip is going to be Micah Parsons. Are you willing to do that? You know, how many guys are you willing to – DeMarcus Lawrence, he's been hurt, but there's teams that say they still are interested for the late season push. There's going to be guys that they have on their roster that teams would take a flyer on or be interested in and be offering you things for. But I think they're thinking that you're trying to do a fire sale. You can't fire sale Micah Parsons, because with that much cap space already tied up, you got to get quite a haul for Micah Parsons if you're trying to rebuild quickly.
Yeah, I just don't feel like Jerry Jones would do that. I don't feel like he would make that sort of a move. Not to say it's the wrong move. Jerry Jones doesn't really always – and I don't know if that's logical to trade Parsons when he's still got a couple of years under his contract. But you mentioned the cap situation. Like, hey, they're going to have to pay him at some point. They've already paid CD. They've already paid Dak, so that's an issue. And then Houston Texans, not a ton of views. Of course, they played Thursday. We'll talk a lot about them. The biggest news, really, DeMeco Ryans talking earlier today. Like, they've announced that Jeff Okuda has been, you know, designated to return to practice, which is okay. Haven't heard that name in a while. As Jerry Hughes has also been designated to return. This doesn't seem great for Nico Collins. And DeMeco was asked about it at the press conference, and DeMeco was like, "Eh, week to week." You know how DeMeco does with injuries.
Yeah.
Day to day, week to week. We're not going to let you know much. Like, you'll figure it out whenever you figure it out. This doesn't seem like great news to me. If you're activating two player, and look, maybe there's gamesmanship here. We know that coaches love to do the gamesmanship thing. But if they're designating Hughes and Okuda to return, and then they're, well, we're week to week with Nico Collins, that doesn't seem like great news to me.
You know what it feels like, Jeremy? It feels like a Dusty Baker move. It feels like, tell me he's ready and we'll take an extra week. And I think that they've kind of leaned that way in the past, that they're not ready to just jump the gun and go too soon. Although Autry did come back on time and played in the Green Bay game when he was eligible. I don't know. We heard that he, you know, on the broadcast the 2 weeks ago that Nico was ahead of schedule, that he was progressing, that he, you
well,
know,
that, remember who told us that?
Well, first it was
originally.
First it was your boy Aaron, and then after that, it made it to the telecast. And I forget who was doing sideline that game, but they reported that he was ahead of schedule and that was progressing really, really well. To where everybody kind of took a sigh of relief going, okay, good, then he should be back. But now you look at it and go, is it also because you're playing maybe the hottest team in the NFL besides Baltimore, and they're going to come in here riding a 7-1 record, playing their best football, and knowing that you're going to have your hands full, and then trying to figure out, is that the best or the worst case scenario to bring a guy like Nico back because their secondary is good?
Mm-hmm.
I think at this point you can't worry about that. I think you need Nico Collins back in this offense if he's capable.
I get where you're coming from there. I don't think that DeMeco would ever do that. I, like, you know, old school football guy. Like, I don't get the sense that he would be – like, he had players in the game when they were down 27 at Minnesota. Like, he doesn't strike me as the, okay, our opponent's really good. Nico's 90%. We're going to hold him out one more week because that defense is really good, or the point spread isn't in our favor. It doesn't strike me as a DeMeco move. Do know where you're coming from on that, though. But I get the sense – just reading the tea leaves on this. Reading the tea leaves. And, look, I hope that I'm terribly wrong, and we know that I've been wrong tons in the past. I'm wrong way more than I'm right. I get the sense he's going to miss this week's game. I get the, just the feeling, like knowing where the report came from, seeing two players that are designated to return. Nico Collins, you know, we'll see where he's at the end of the week, which DeMeco does do that with everybody. I would put it at 60-40 he does not play Sunday.
Yeah, I hope you're wrong just because of the fact that, you know, he, like we even said, he was
traveling. I hope I'm wrong.
Yeah, he was traveling. It seemed like, you know, he looked like he was in good spirits on the sideline.
He did.
I'm just thinking, hey, man, you know what? When we watched the offense, for as many struggles as they had, the one thing that really kind of threw the timing and everything else off was when CJ went off script and we knew he had to do it almost on every play moving out of the pocket, his security blanket has always been Nico. And when Nico's not there, trying to get the other guys to do the same kind of things and get the same kind of timing when a lot of those are pinpoint throws and he's got, you know, and the timing has to be impeccable, they just weren't there. And so you want to give your best effort every week, but especially against a better opponent like the Lions. It sucks if he's not able to play, but look, this is a long haul, and you know that this is for the big picture of this team going forward in the to get a playoff spot and then move forward. You got to have Nico Collins, or your chances are diminished greatly offensively in the big picture.
Give me your odds that he plays Sunday.
Probably
60% he doesn't play.
I'll go 50-50.
Okay,
I'll go. It's a coin flip at this point, but yeah, that would suck because again, I was buying into the fact that he's sit out the 4 weeks and he'll be right back.
Yeah, you know, it could be just thinking out loud here a little bit. It could be transactional too. You know that they picked up a couple of linemen today, play some of the practice squad, trade deadline tomorrow. You know that maybe they're just keeping that roster spot open for some reason. We'll see. It'll be fun to monitor that throughout the week. Mailbag Monday coming up later in the show. Game balls. What do you believe after this college football weekend? And film don't lie. It was not an easy film to watch, Blankers. It was hard. It was a hard one to watch. It's like, this team, this offensive line is dreadful. But we see Dennis Allen fired. We also see Luke Getsy, the offensive coordinator for the Raiders, fired. You, as a Texan fan, do you want Bobby Slowick fired? Do you wish it was your offensive coordinator that was sacked today, not the Raiders' offensive coordinator? 713-780-ESPN, the HRMP listener line. We're on the Twitch, twitch.tv/ESPN at 97.5. We're on YouTube at ESPN Houston. You can find us on Twitter at ESPN 975. On Twitter, Blankers is at Pac-Man Joel. I'm at Jeremy Branham. We are the Killer Bees on ESPN 97.5 and ESPN 92.5. One of the great things in life, you know, basketball season starting today. Did you know that? College basketball season opening day is today. It's one of my favorite things. Professional basketball has been going on for a little while, so you're probably going to be jonesing to shoot some hoops. You might be jonesing to throw down some slams. You saw a great dunk on the highlights. You're like, hey, I can do that. Well, get a goal from Pro Dunk and try it. They make the highest quality basketball goals that you will find. Tempered glass backboard gives you that true, authentic feel. Breakaway rim. What do I need that for? Because you're going to be throwing down some jams because you can lower the goal all the way down to 5 feet. Raise it up to 10 feet. Work on the shot. Whatever you want to do. Stainless steel hardware. It is rust proof. You got to have that in Houston. And as we mentioned, it is height adjustable. Their new goal, Thor. You can raise and lower the goals with a drill. It's called their lightning adjust feature. 5 to 10 feet in a matter of seconds. Easy to do, and it's fun to do. Their accessories, next level as well. LED light kits for night play, backstop nets, pole pad lettering, and lots, lots more. You can order all of this online at ProDunk.com. You can also get their professional installation. You're a little intimidated by a big box delivered to your driveway, and you have to assemble 1,000 pieces. You're not doing that with ProDunk. You're not going to screw it up because the pros from ProDunk will do that for you. Yes, they will professionally install your goal, perfect height, perfectly straight. You don't lift a finger. Let the pros do the hard work for you. Give them a call right now. Get the greatest goal on the planet from ProDunk, 281-351-9822, 281-351-9822, or visit them online, ProDunk.com. That's ProDunk.com.
ESPN 97.5. Broadcasting live from the Veritex Community Bank Studios, it's the Killer Bees with Joel Blank and Jeremy Branham.
On ESPN 97.5 and 92.5.
ESPN 97.5, ESPN 92.5, 0979 says Dion. It'd be fun. Is there another good example of coach being successful as a coach and GM? I mean, I can't really think of one in the NFL. Like, if it happened kind of in the not the modern era of the NFL. Can you think of one?
Wasn't at one point, wasn't the older Shanahan in full control of everything when he went to, I want to say maybe Washington? Maybe in his Denver days. when they were at the peak of their success that they gave Shanahan a ton of control like that?
I think Shanahan had a GM in Washington, but he was the one calling the shots.
Right,
he was the general manager was his right hand man. And nothing was done unless it crossed Shanahan's desk. So yeah, that's a good call on that one. And that one failed. I wondered in an alternate reality if they could have just kept Cousins and made him the guy. I wonder if that would have worked, because that staff was incredible. And I think Shanahan is a much better coach than what he was given credit for there. Belichick comes to mind. Parcells, of course, comes to mind.
Yep.
You know, if I'm gonna do the cooking, then I gotta be able to buy the groceries. I ultimately don't think it's a good thing though in football, because you're usually as a head coach very right now oriented. You're looking at the tree, not the forest, and I think it's a very dangerous spot to be. Now, if you can find somebody who's unique enough to be able to do that, then okay. But there's so much scouting goes into it, scouring the waiver wire. Now, you can have your assistants that help out there, but I think it's two very, very different jobs, and we saw how bad it was here with Bill O'Brien.
That's what I was just going to say. We saw how bad it was with Bill O'Brien and how time-consuming of a job both of them are. So it's tough to say that you're going to go week to week as the head coach with all your responsibilities, duties, and the time that it takes to do that, and then you're going to also have the same amount of time without jeopardizing the other side of the job, which is the personnel side and the general manager side and the week-to-week cuts and you know, moves that need to be made and all those things. And at some point, one side or the other is going to probably suffer a little bit. And I don't think in this day's football it makes sense. I think the best combinations are like McVay has with the Rams. They have a GM, but he's involved in every decision, and I'm sure it's just about how much time he has to give. On the flip side, the GM side of things, they're doing the stuff you're talking about with all the intel and the scouting and the research to make sure they make the right calls.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that Matt Rhule had a good amount of power in Carolina, which was atrocious. I feel like Sean Payton has a good amount of power now, which is kind of still up in the air, only his second year. They're probably playing – their win-loss record with the roster they have is probably better in the last year and a half than we thought it would be, but still a team that's pretty far away from true contention in the NFL. I think they proved that yesterday with their loss to Baltimore. I think it's very difficult. I think it can be done, but you have to have a head coach who isn't win now at all cost and at all times. And then you also have to be able to give your assistant general managers a lot of control. Like, you can have the final say, but you're really not doing the job.
I think, and ideally, I think it, like Andy Reid comes to mind as a guy that probably could have it if he wants it, but would rather and prefer to have a guy that he trusts that they have a good chemistry and communication balance with, to where he doesn't have to. Like, he knows he's going to be involved when the decisions are being made, but at the same time, he does not want to be involved in all the other BS that goes with it and all the work that goes in on that side. And I think that's what you're seeing develop with teams like the Texans, when Nick and D'Amico have the synergy to where they know that they can discuss it at the right time, but neither one has to be overly involved in the other's business.
Yeah, I'm with you on that. 713-780-ESPN. A lot of people have been calling for Bobby Slowick's job, which to me is pretty crazy, considering he was a good offensive coordinator last year. I think he's been okay this year. I think that there's a lot of restrictions he has this year that he didn't have last year for some reason. I don't know why this offensive line is worse than it was a year ago. The players on the offensive line certainly seem like they should be better. But 713-780-3776. Do you wish it was Bobby Slowick, not Luke Getsy, who got fired from their offensive coordinator job? What do you think, Blanker?
Yeah, I don't at all. And I think that it's ridiculous that, you know, we're so short-sighted sometimes and we're so reactionary that suddenly – you know, a year ago when everybody was like, God, what are we going to do without Bobby Slowick? And Bobby Slowick, it's unbelievable. We're hoping he doesn't take a job. And then hopefully we have him for one more year because we know he's going to get a head coaching job. And now it's like, Bobby Slowick sucks. He's got to go. He's the problem. You just can't, you know, you can jump off the bandwagon that quick, but you're just not being realistic. The fact is that just like D'Amico, where D'Amico's made mistakes and D'Amico's had, you know, some slip-ups where we go, hey, he's learning as he goes. Slowick had a lot of success early on, and everybody was quick to promote this guy as this prodigy that was going to be head coach in waiting. When things aren't going as smoothly, he's going to take some hits. But at the end of the day, you're not going to remove him, and you're not going to remove him now. And we're watching what's going around around the league. When you're moving a guy in the middle of the season as a coordinator, you're basically in desperation mode, and you're basically admitting that you can't fix it, and there's nothing that's going on in the building that is a positive on that front. I think that it would create more disarray than it would hope that they could finish the season stronger. So I'm totally against it, and I'm a bit surprised that people are calling for that.
Yeah, I am too. My group chat was giving me some grief yesterday because I was lamenting at Cliff Kingsbury and the job that he's doing in Washington. Remember that D'Amico Ryans interviewed Cliff Kingsbury for the OC job. Now, was that real or was it kind of, you know, both parties just kind of doing their due diligence? I don't know. But I do wish that the Texans would have Cliff instead of Slowik. I think he's a better play caller. And my approval rating for Slowik has went down. Like last year it was very high, I'll admit that. But right now, it's not great. Like, it's probably, you know, close to 50, a 50 approval rating. I'm nowhere near firing him, though. I still think he's a solid play caller. Now, there are some tendencies that I'm picking up on that don't exactly thrill me. Mm-hmm. I don't know how good he is as a second half, game plan adjuster. We look at the point margin first half, second half, and it's not good. The Texans have not been a good football team in the second half, and that's both sides of the ball. That's just not on the offensive side of the ball. But how much is Bobby Slowik adjusting to what the defense is throwing at him? Numbers would tell you that that's not pretty.
No, and we've talked about it. They haven't scored a touchdown in the second half in three games. There's no adjustments being made at halftime like you would at least expect that they would be doing that would be somewhat noticeable. And from the standpoint of when the team is suffering, even if it is, you know, driven by the offensive line and some injuries, you've got to answer to the fact that your play calling hasn't been great and you're supposed to be, again, adjusting on the fly based on who you have, don't have, and what you're dealing with in terms of the performance of the guys on your roster. I just think that it would be a dumb move because I think that it would be trying to reshuffle the deck in the middle of a season when if you bring in a new OC, you're not going to bring in someone from the outside, chances are, because of the fact that you're not going to be ready to start redoing the playbook and installing a bunch of new stuff. You're going to try and make do with what you have with just a different creative philosophy in terms of the play calling and the way that they go about it, and then hope for the best. I think Bobby Slowik is learning. I think he's fine. It's fair to criticize him because of how poorly some of the play calls have been and the way they haven't adjusted. But at the same time, I think they're too good of a team record-wise right now to be screwing around.
Yeah, I would agree with you there. Like the because you're not hiring somebody from the outside. So it'd either be Gerard Johnson, who's never called plays before, or Bill Lazor. Bill Lazor's has called plays before. Now it doesn't really excite you. Now the part that you said where Bobby Slowik's still learning, like no one wants to hear that a year and a half into the gig. Whenever you have a team that should win the AFC South and was supposed to be this team that could be, you know, a dark horse Super Bowl contender. So like the learning aspect of it's not something I really want to hear.
Yeah, but I think it's a reality. I think that we've seen this with head coaches and coaches throughout sports, but specifically as it relates to the NFL. Sure, they pick up on a lot of things, but I still think that, you know, at a certain point, there are still things that you're going to be, whether you admit it publicly or not, that you're going to realize, hey, I've got to be better here. I'm not paying enough attention to this. Maybe I need to reevaluate how I'm doing that. And it could be anything from how you're managing and meeting with your other coaches instead of just relying on them as it relates to offensive line or other position groups. It could be, you know, how you're managing situation and time or adjusting at the half when you know teams have done this and that. It's not a perfect science. So I would love to believe after 1 year's time that he's got it all under his belt and he's good to go and these aren't going to happen. But you know, I also think that you're going to be put under everybody's under the microscope a lot quicker with a lot more magnification when you're not playing good football, and they're not playing good football, and he's at the top of the list.
The other thing that I wonder with Slowik, too, is if he's kind of a round peg, square hole type of coach where, like, the best coaches are the ones that can kind of cater what they're trying to do with whatever their personnel is. I'm wondering if Slowik, because, hey, this is what we do, that he's not always the best at understanding the limitations of his offensive personnel and that he still throws, you know, the round peg square hole and you got to figure this out. Because, look, I mean, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out this offense. And, look, if you want to blame Kenyon Green, if you want to blame the offense, whoever you want to blame, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out that this offensive line, it has trouble pass protecting, okay? Mm-hmm. We all know that. You go into the game Thursday night against the Jets knowing they have a good defensive line. Hassan Reddick hasn't played a lot, but he's still very talented. Quinnen Williams is one of the best defensive tackles, if not the best defensive tackle in the entire NFL. And Quinnen Williams winning matchup after matchup with whatever K. Green that he's facing, whether it was Kenyon Green or Kendra Green, he was owning both of them. So it's like, okay, why aren't you trying to do something a little different? Why not keep the running back and some pass protection on that side of the football to help him out? So, like, there's – and again – if you know that your pass protection stinks, how are you giving up 8 sacks in a game? Like, you have to call the game so much differently when you know your pass protection's poor. Like, even if you know you have the worst offensive line in the NFL, let's just assume for a second that the Houston Texans offensive line, and this might be the case, is the worst pass protecting team in the NFL. Let's assume that. What are you going to do as a play caller to try to prevent your quarterback from getting sacked a lot? Plays that don't lead to sacks. See, so, like, you should never have 8 sacks in a football game, ever, no matter what your offensive line is.
It goes back to what I mentioned previously. When you get guys, especially slower than CJ-type guys, but when Green Bay did this forever and a day with Aaron Rodgers, when either he was hurt or the line was less than, well, they ran a pistol. They started with running the pistol, so the ball got back to him a little bit quicker. He could start to get through his progressions a little bit earlier, and then he could also move at a moment's notice to start getting sliding in and around the pocket to where there was a little bit of extra time if he needed to buy some time. And then you run a lot more play action, and you run a lot more to where it's quick passes, and it get it out of his hands quickly, and do the things like chipping and using the backs and the tight ends. But it's all about the process so that you can adjust, and it just does. It goes back to everything, even with the second half adjustments. It just doesn't seem like that light's on in terms of, oh yeah, I can probably help, as bad as my offensive line has been, to at least make this at least as a little easier or a little bit more smooth than it's been. And I don't think they've been doing that.
Second half adjustments in a little round peg square hole. Like, those are things that are catching my attention. Because the more you get to know somebody, the more you start to notice their weaknesses. This is just life with anybody. So those are things that I'm keeping an eye on Slug. But absolutely not. I don't think that he should get fired. Do you? 713-780-3776. Tomorrow's the NFL trade deadline. Can the Texans save their season ahead of the deadline? 713-780-3776. It's the Bees on ESPN 97.5 and ESPN 92.5.
You're listening to ESPN 97.5 and 92.5. You found the Killer Bees live from the Veritex Community Bank Studios. Here's Joel Blank and Jeremy Branham.
We are the Bees. It is ESPN 97.5, ESPN 92.5. 713-780-3776. A couple of texts on this. If your OC was out there blocking on the offensive line, I can see why you'd want to get rid of him. But the big problem is the line, not the offensive coordinator. See, I do agree with that. The pass protection is the bigger reason. But again, how are you as a play caller drawing up plays to where your quarterback gets sacked 8 times knowing that you have a bad line in a game that you were running well? Like, you were running well in this game too, so like, it's not, and you were running better in the first half than the second half, so we'll be completely fair there. But if you're running well, it's never more than a one possession game until very, very late. You're leading for a majority of the game. How in the world are you as a play caller getting your quarterback sacked 8 times in a game like that?
Yeah, I mean, look, there's plenty of questions worth asking, and a lot of times we know that no matter what, how many times it's asked and how it's positioned, even if it is asked by, you know, members of the media, that the Texans aren't going to answer that. And it's there's so many things that are so peculiar about the entire situation, because the other thing is, normally when your line is bad, your line is just bad. But when you look at this line, you go, well, they're successful running the football. And a lot of that is to the credit of Joe Mixon, because a lot of times the holes aren't mammoth either, but his jump cuts, his ability to stay quick twitch and be able to kind of create something out of nothing or change directions has helped. But at the same time, they have been serviceable in the running game and maybe a little better than that, which is why it's even more perplexing that they can't pass block. And you can point the finger at Kenyon Green because he's never been a good pass blocker. But for the majority of the rest of the offensive line, and specifics, the three veterans that you have on this offensive line, they've been there, done that, and done it well for the majority of their career, at least with two of them, because Shaq has done it and Tunsil's done it. And for the most part, Howard's gotten better. He's gotten paid like he should be able to do it. So it's crazy that we're also sitting here looking at a line that, if you're going to be bad, it would normally be that they're bad all across the board. But with the exception of the left guard position, everybody else has had experience and been a better than average run blocker and pass blocker. That's what's perplexing to me. They just absolutely suck at pass blocking.
Yeah, Juice hasn't been that good this year. If you look at, like, the PFF grade, and I think if you watch, like, Juice has been kind of average. And then if you want to throw in the whole, like, coverage and protection calls, you know, maybe there's an issue there. And then I think Shaq Mason has regressed, too. I don't think that Shaq Mason's as good as he was last year. And maybe that's the collective line that's making him look worse. Like, I will, you know, allow that to be possible. But, Juice hasn't been as good as I thought he would be. And I don't think Shaq Mason's been as good as he was last year. But you're right, Kenyon Green. It has been the major issue. 8807, why does it seem like this line is elite at run blocking and awful at pass blocking? I think that goes to what you said, Blank, because yep. I think Joe Mixon kind of covers up some warts there.
Oh, he really does. I mean, when you go back and look at the film and watch it as much as we do, and you see, especially the second time around, the fact that he just has this innate ability to be able to – we talked last year about Devin Singletary, and he was able to kind of slowly get to the hole sometimes and pause just to wait for something else to open up. He does it a different way where he gets to the line quickly, but then his ability to change directions, his shiftiness and his quick twitch and jump and his jump cuts create a lot of like small little openings he gets through. And then he's able to use his physicality along with his athleticism to get you extra yards to where the running game looks a lot better than what the line maybe by itself is doing. But in combination with a really good running back, the running game has been the bell cow literally that has been carrying this team in a lot of situations offensively.
4515, if anyone needs to go, it's the GM. Second offseason in a row that he didn't address the offensive line. Well, he drafted a tackle in the second round. Now that tackle in the second round is not playing. He addressed the offensive line the year prior to that, too, though. I mean, he drafted Juice Scruggs in the second, traded up for him, drafted Jared Patterson in the sixth. What do you mean helped the offensive line? He's only a six-rounder, but he started games for you. Mm-hmm. He also traded for Shaq Mason. Yep. So, like, two off-seasons ago, I would completely disagree. I think he made a lot of moves to the offensive line. Now, this past off-season, Fisher was a second-rounder, but he's not playing. So, like, I'm not going to use Blake Fisher as a testimony to using a whole lot of resources on the offensive line this past off-season. Question I would have, though, is should he have? Like, you went into the season with a pretty good idea of what your offensive line was going to be. Like, you're not really worried about left tackle. Laramie's there. Juice Scruggs is either going to be your center or your left guard, probably your center. Jared Patterson's going to be interior offensive line depth, and you're comfortable with that. Shaq Mason's going to be your right guard. Titus Howard's going to be your right tackle. I would say the only thing that you could blame Caserio about is that, you know, maybe you should have had this veteran left guard and Kenyon Green was so bad, which he is. I'll hear that, but I don't think that Nick Caserio should get a whole lot of grief for not addressing this offensive line.
No, I gave him grief where I thought he really deserved it, which was a year ago when we were dealing with Kenyon Green and found out after the fact that he was injured and he didn't have a backup plan and that he knew it was a when, not an if, that he was going to go down. And I thought that that was really poorly handled, but I also thought that on the fly, he brought in a couple of veterans that were able to at least help to shoulder the load and get you by to where you weren't horrible. From this year's perspective, I think it's more of the standpoint of every general manager is going to be a little more hyper-protective of a guy he drafted, especially as highly as he drafted Kenyon Green. And I think that the hope was that now that he transformed his body and he was eating better, in better shape, stronger, that he was really settling in and maturing more, that the hope was that he didn't need to do anything more than that. But you can't leave it to chance. You have to still have at least one guy backing him up that isn't the two rookies that you drafted, as you mentioned, the previous year. It doesn't hurt you to get, because they're not that expensive and you have money to play with, to where you could have gotten one serviceable, experienced guard on a that could maybe play double positions that could be on your roster just in case, because we all were pointing fingers going, if there's one guy that still has the ability to crap the bed here, it would be Kenyon Green.
Yeah, I think that could be the one spot. And you're right about last offseason. I agree with you on that. If you knew that he had some sort of shoulder ailment, then it's like, hey, maybe you have a guy that's a capable starter. And I think they got bailed out by Jared Patterson being good. You know, the fact that you had a six-rounder that could play solid snaps for you as a rookie is pretty miraculous, quite mm-hmm. frankly. Now, that does go back to, well, who found him? Who drafted him? So you have to give him credit for drafting a guy, while we're also in the other breath saying that he kind of got lucky with what a six-rounder became in his rookie year. A couple of techs saying that the plan should be, I guess this is assuming they don't make a trade ahead of tomorrow's deadline, which I do think it's hard to acquire linemen during the deadline, although Minnesota did it. A lot of people are clamoring for the idea of playing Titus Howard at left guard and Blake Fisher at right tackle. I think, Blankers, if you're going to make a change internally, and assuming that Jared Patterson's back from concussion, I kind of want to see what Jared Patterson looks like at center. I think I would go Patterson center, Juice Scruggs at left guard before I go Titus Howard at left guard.
Yeah, I mean, there's a couple of different elements to look at here. One, I don't think Fisher's ready, and you and I talked about that a week or so ago, and I was adamant about the fact that, look, I think they drafted him to be a tackle of this team in the future and give you the backup plan in case you want to move on from Howard at the end of the season. I think that he was being groomed as a guy that, again, we saw this when they drafted Reed in the third round as a safety years ago, that, hey, you weren't drafting him for this season, but he was projected to be a first-round pick. If you give him time and get him experience, he can be in your future plans as a starter, and that's why they took him where they did. But I think that you also don't want to move too many dominoes. You don't want to move too many pieces around. I'm leaning your direction. I don't want to see a rookie thrown into the right tackle spot and then take a guy that doesn't want to leave the right tackle spot anyway and was adamant about putting that on Twitter and then move him to guard. I think that what I would like to see is, whether you believe that Juice is capable at center or not, at the very least, I need Patterson in the picture. If he fills in and he takes over for Kenyon Green, so be it. We'll try that first. If you still need to do more and it's still not working, then I would put Patterson back at center as well and try and figure out what you're going to do at left guard. But I sincerely hope that that means that one of those elements is they are out there trying to find a solution on the trade market at guard. Sure. Because I just think that you can't stand pat at this. No matter, D'Amico's not going to tell you anything anyway. He's not going to be like Dan Campbell and get excited and say, you know, we're working on things. They're going to be very tight-lipped into Nick's vest. They're going to be tight to the vest. I just think that they have to do something to get some depth at offensive line.
Yeah, Titus playing left guard would be the third move, and you know, I would go Patterson, Juice, center, left guard in some combination, first and second, plan A, plan B, and then that final plan will be Titus. I don't care about Titus's feelings as much as others. For me, it's simply what do I think my best offensive line is, and Titus, to me, that would be the third option of that mix.
But that third option scares me to death because Fisher playing right tackle, he's not ready.
Well, I think it's your only option, though. Like, I mean, if the first two options, I think we nailed. Like, It's probably Juice at center, Patterson at left guard, and that was the plan until Patterson got concussed. Like, they already showed us that was the plan. The second option in my mind is you flip-flop those, because if, and we don't know, but if the center at this particular time, Juice Scruggs, is the one that's putting you in these bad coverages, well, let's see what Patterson does. Let's see if that looks a little bit different if things continue to be poor. I don't think there's another option after that other than Titus at left guard.
No, I think that's, again, now, you know, if you go with the Jets philosophy, and Rodgers was talking about this last week, that at a certain point they just decided in regards to what we were discussing about taking a tackle and moving him to guard, that the Jets finally just decided that their best option to be able to be serviceable as an offensive line was take four tackles and put them across your offensive line and just make sure that as long as they just do their jobs, whatever they're doing as doing their jobs is better than what they've been doing as an offensive line. At a certain point, maybe if you're Nick Caserio, you don't even have to specifically say, I'm looking for a guard. I just need to get guys that can hold their own at their given position enough to buy my quarterback more time for our offense to be able to do what it needs to do.
Wouldn't that be speaking to Titus Howard at left guard, though, then?
I'm saying that's one of the things. Right. I said, as is in relation to that, then maybe that's that. But then maybe what my point in saying that, too, is then maybe you don't have to be looking for a guard. Maybe you look for a right tackle or a tackle and say, hey, look, I'm going to move Howard to the position that he's played previously that's helped us, but I don't trust Blake Fisher. So what I'm going to do is, in the trade market when I was looking for a guard, instead of doing that, I know that I've got a guy that can be serviceable at guard. Now I'm going to go find a right tackle that's better than Fisher to get me through the rest of the season.
If you can't trust a second-round tackle, though, then you probably shouldn't have drafted him. Like, it's two separate conversations, I understand.
But also, both can be true, right?
Yeah, for sure.
So if you just – but because there's too much on the line, because you are still in a good position for the playoffs – you got to do what you got to do to get it through the end of the season, and I think that if you had to look for a right tackle, then so be it.
So do you think the Texans can save their season at the deadline?
I actually do. I do believe that, again, unlike skill position players or a team that needs a quarterback that you're going to like try and get to learn the playbook on the fly, I really believe that if they can get an offensive lineman or two, and I just think it could be as easy as one, but if you get the right one, I think that this is good. That could be good enough to do what you need to do to have a successful season and save it.
7151, I don't think they do anything they should, but won't. I think Caserio will do something. Caserio's very, very aggro. He's very aggressive. Now, I would have the opposite opinion. I don't think that there's enough that can be done tomorrow that saves the Houston Texans season. I think that even if they improve, I think even if they add some pieces to this offensive line, I think this offensive line is going to be what holds back the Houston Texans from being this super dark horse contender in the AFC.
But doesn't that again get back to where we think it's what's saving the season, right? If it's saving the season means it's yep. AFC championship or more, then yeah, I'm leaning right now that this team is too far away from being an AFC title game contender. But is it getting to the playoffs and being able to be respectable and competitive in games against better teams the rest of the season and giving you a better chance to win? That is definitely in the cards to be able to pull off.
I feel like best case scenario, though, right now, even without a trade, it's divisional round, and I feel like best case scenario with a trade is still divisional round.
Maybe so.
So, like, to me, it's not going to move the needle in terms of they're going to be around better because of a trade. Could they be a win better? I'm with you there. Could they be better, like, just the product? I'm with you there. But I don't think that there's anything that they do that jumps them around in terms of their promise this season.
Well, but you know what? But you look at Tampa and you look at teams in the past that probably weren't supposed to have a puncher's chance. But anything can happen in the playoffs where you can stay competitive as long as you can give your quarterback time. And having the right quarterback can make plays that can make a difference to where sometimes you can buck the trend and beat the odds and have a game where you just you find it or the other team's off a little bit. And you look at what Green Bay did a year ago with the Niners, competing with the Niners for most of the game after beating a Cowboy team they were supposed to get beat by. CJ, if you give him the ability to have the time, has proven that he can do a lot of things to make your offense better than it is. The biggest problem is that, you know, who you play, when you play them is going to matter. And yep. I would think it would be, if you're going to be, can you save it at the deadline? Then it's more than an offensive lineman. Then it's an offensive lineman and maybe another receiver so that you can bolster two spots where you know you've taken a significant hit, whether it be by poor play or an injury.
Can the Texans save their season to the deadline? Also, tomorrow is the NFL trade deadline. What are your favorite and least favorite trades that Nick Caserio has made as the general manager of the Texans? 713-780-3776. It's the Bees on ESPN 97.5 and ESPN 92.5.
Hey, before we go to the break, a word from a good friend, Doc Linville. Doc Linville, right here in the Houston Medical Center, and he is fantastic. He is a game changer when it comes to getting your hair back. He does a ton of stuff. And I mean, right now they got creams that can try and get your abs back if that's something that's driving you. If you want to get into plastic surgery, spa treatments, Botox, AJ was thinking about the abs as we speak, actually considering it as I said it. But there's all kinds of options. But the thing that he's really, really good at that AJ doesn't need is the fact that he's good at getting your hair back. If you've got pattern baldness and your hair is gone, you think there's nothing you can do and you don't want to try all the gimmicks that are out there that are just basically masking the problem, all you got to do is see Doc Linville. The Neograft can get your hair back and it's your own hair. If it's just that you have hair, but it's thinner than it used to be, it's not thick and strong like it used to be, and you want that lush hair back again, then all you got to do is go to Doc Linville and start with PRP treatments. PRP treatments is like fertilizing your lawn. It gets the blades of grass to be stronger, longer, have more durability, be there for the long haul, and give you a better overall look. The Neograft, same thing. It's like resodding your lawn. It's taking hair from areas that you're never going to lose it, the sides and the back of your head, putting it where you need it most. Maybe it's your hairline in front or the baboon's butt that's showing on the top of your head. He's got the answers if you're willing to listen. And right now, all you got to do is listen and set up a free consultation that normally costs $150 for people off the street just by going to 975hair.com. Go to the website, 975hair.com. Sign up for a free consultation. It costs you nothing. There's no obligation, no signing on the dotted line, no money out of pocket. Just a Q&A where they explain to you what they can do. You ask questions, get answers, and consider if it's something you might want to do. If you do, you're going to the best, and you're going to get the results. You get your hair back. I'm here to tell you that because I did both, and I've seen the results, and I still got the results, and I am proud to say Doc Linville was the guy that got it all done. Check it out today. Tell them I sent you by. Go to 975hair.com.
You're listening to ESPN 97.5.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
League's Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning League's Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and Leon starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. League's Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.